Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Isaac Yuen, a Hong Kong-Canadian author, and tonight we're talking about his first solo book, Utter Earth, Advice on Living in a More-Than-Human World. Isaac, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Nice to talk to you again, Mark.
I don't know what I was expecting, but it wasn't this. And I say that in the best possible.
That's a compliment.
Yeah, it is. It is. Actually, it really totally is. I thought it was going to be some real, I was going to enjoy it. I knew because I've read your writing before. I thought it was going to be this thing about, you know, extinction. And it is about these things. But it's more of a performance art piece than anything else. Do you agree?
Yeah. I think that's sort of like being in the field, like thinking and working in sort of the environmental field and dealing with issues of species extinction and biodiversity quite a lot. I think I was looking to find a way through that was a little bit more unexpected, a little bit more surprising, and working on different sort of emotional registers than your standard nature writing. So this is kind of like a mix between sort of a whimsical book and poignant moments and some experimental stuff. And yeah, I think it's something that I had a lot of fun writing.
I have to read so many books a week, like sometimes up to four a week, and I do read them all. Sure. So whenever a book surprises me, I'm like amazed. I'm like, what the word? I had no idea where this was going. I had just no clue. Talk to me about what caused you to write this book. Like what really sort of inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that the germ of it really started when I was actually doing some volunteer work at a natural history museum in Vancouver in Canada.
Ooh, that would do it.
BD Biodiversity Museum. Mm. And as a volunteer, you engage with the public and you're in this place with all these specimens that are locked away in cabinets. And I was like, well, I have to do sort of an educational sort of display. So I was like, how do I convey, these specimens that are in the back to a general audience? It could be adults, it could be kids. And I was trying to find a way to thread through, a bunch of specimens. And one of the ways is really through, storytelling and connecting seemingly different creatures and animals and fossils and bones to some common theme, And one of the common theme for that particular talk was on living fossils. Mm. So ancient creatures that are still maybe around but haven't changed very much in many millions of years. So I picked a bunch of stuff. Some of them are plants, some of them are fish, and then started to sort of weave together a story about it. And I thought that was a really fun way to sort of tell a story. And I started exploring different voices as well in terms of how to tell the story. So eventually that turned into an essay, and in the book, it's an essay called Life Lessons from the Odd and Ancient, and that became sort of the first essay that I wrote. I was like, maybe I can start writing more of these in this particular whimsical voice, in the voice of this narrator that's kind of rambling and meandering, but hopefully comes to some sort of point at the end, and that became a really fun and fun way to explore the natural world.
Before we even talk about the contents, even the design and the layout of the book is interesting because, the symbols that you have of a creature, the sort of graphic, and I'm sure this is on purpose, but it reminds me exactly of the kind of things you see when you're at a zoo. You want to find the reptile house, there would be that symbol on a sign and then an arrow. And they were designed exactly like that. Who designed them for you, or did you do it?
Yeah, so this is also a really great story. I really actually just reached out to a designer whose work I really liked. He's a Buffalo-based graphic designer, artist, sort of self-taught artist, Julian Montague. And I had first seen his work in a literary magazine where he redesigned their layout. And I was like, he does a lot of sort of minimalist material, mid-modern, sort of mid-century modern styles. And I was like, I think for a book that's quite dense, I want something a little bit more minimal to in terms of the illustrations or the graphics to sort of counterbalance the two sides. And the idea of, you know, like, you're exactly right, these like silhouettes of creatures that are you can find at the zoo, you know, leading you to, you know, the reptile house or whatever. I thought that was kind of a neat way to signpost some of the animals or creatures that will be explored in a particular essay. And so we were kind of brainstorming and doing this and trying to decide, because there's also an element of it, we really wanted it to be kind of like an old field guide.
Yep,
Sort of old school 70s field guides where it's quite minimal in stylings. And I had seen his work. He did a series called, I think it's called States of America, where he would do a silhouette similar to these for every state. He would have a creature or a plant or something that's very minimal and had a name. And I really was drawn to that series. And so we talked, and he agreed to sort of do both the illustrations in the book and also design the font and the cover as well. So that was a really fun experience.
I think it really swings, because within the context of the writing, it really sort of sets a tone of how the reader is to approach this material. And one of the first things, just starting the book, I really came away with your passion for biodiversity. In an interesting way, as a kid, I was a biodiversity nerd. We had all these really, really old books, like going back to the early 1900s, were animal books. They were like sort of huge compendiums of books about animals and stuff like that. And I used to just sit and read those for hours and become fascinated and say, like, I wanted to go to these places. I wanted to see these creatures. One of the ones from one of the oldest books I have is a golden mole.
Golden mole, yes.
Yeah, it was in your book. And
my book.
And it's just so funny how many of these animals in these old books that included really old photography, too, are in your book. So, I mean, talk to me about you and biodiversity.
I think we have a lot in common in that sort of shared passion growing up as a kid. You know, I grew up, you know, with books. Animal books were sort of my first connection to a greater world, like to a world that allows you to go to different places different creatures that you would never see. You know, we didn't really go to zoos or anything. So books were really important. And for me also, like, I remember I had these like half volumes of like encyclopedias from bookstores.
Yeah.
That would be these like 60s, 70s, like,
The Golden Book series? Did you have the Golden Book?
A little bit. I definitely have a Golden Book. There's other ones. I've kind of lost track of them, but I just remember, like, you know, reading the stories or the life history behind these creatures. And they were written in a very specific tone. You know, like, it would be like, you know, like distribution or like creatures that prey on it or what does it eat or things like that, and would just be like short little excerpts on these sorts of things. And I would love those books. I still remember fondly about sort of the stylings and formatting and those images that you mentioned. But like, also, I think part of the motivation for this book is, like, I think I wrote it back. It's like, it's kind of my adult take on an animal book for maybe grown-ups.
You're right. You're right. And that's why I identified with it.
I'm trying to evoke that particular feeling too. So.
And the funny thing is, you do have that chapter at the very, very end, which I thought was just hilarious. The brief thoughts on almost every mentioned mostly living thing in alphabetical order. Mm-hmm. And it's like a quick take, like you have in a high school yearbook, about all those creatures. And it's all true.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I had to finish the the sort of the collection of essays first before I can really tackle that, because it really was like I wrote the book, and then I was like, I think I need a capstone or something at the end to sort of, you know, like just sum up everything. And then, so I was like, maybe a glossary would be good, because these sorts of books always had a glossary.
Yep.
You can look up what the creature was. And if you weren't sure what you were reading about, that would be helpful for the reader to look up what this particular creature was. So I entered in everything into a spreadsheet, basically, and I ended up with, I think, 512 species that was mentioned throughout the book, whatever it was, just a name drop or whether I went into more detail about it. I was like, it would be fun for me to sort of just give my thoughts, or the narrator giving their...
Some of them are absolutely hilarious.
Thoughts. Yeah, into each of a, just a quick summary or a comment about it, and it turned into this like exercise and just like write the first thing that came to mind a little bit.
Yep, I can see that. I can see that.
Yeah, and then I got into this flow and I started reading this book by John Lloyd and Douglas Adams. It's The Meaning of Life. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It's like, it's supposed to be The Meaning of Life, but...
Well, John, are you talking about
Douglas Adams?
Douglas Adams of the Hitchhiker's Guide.
Hitchhikers.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's full of these terms of words that aren't words, but they feel like words. And so they would make an exercise in sort of describing these non-words as words. And I really love that idea of just like, whatever comes, and it's, you know, it has this really funny, irreverent tone, and I wanted to incorporate that into the book. So the glossary came, and I've heard a lot of comments from readers that they really appreciate that and just had a good chuckle sometimes. And humor sometimes is a little hard to convey, but I'm glad that, you know, at least maybe some of them make sense or elicit some sort of smile or chuckle.
I just want to read one. I just opened it up, and this is the first one I came to. It said... Under star pearlfish, up to 15 fish can squat inside one sea cucumber's anus. The housing market's rough out there. Now, people listening to that may think you just made that. That's absolutely true.
Yes. And I just find that the natural world is full of these sorts of findings.
Yeah, oh yeah.
We go, what is happening? But like, it can also be relatable in our day-to-day life. I think that's really funny. I think I've mentioned like things about the state of the economy or something in one of the essays, and I just think it's kind of funny to bring it back sometimes of this sort of wondrous, you know, mysterious world that we know very little about, and but make it relatable on human terms. So.
And also, an awful lot of the information is really fascinating, deeply fascinating, and sort of weirdly symbolic, although you may not be able to put your finger on what the connection is. Like a good example, it's very poetic, and again, also true, that the songs of the humpback whales are in fact deep into space on Voyager 1. And the weird thing is, and you point this out, it was not mixed in with the other animal sounds that are on that recording on Voyager 1. Mm-hmm. It was mixed with human hellos. See, I find that really fascinating.
Yeah, I think that was such a deliberate decision. You know,
trust me, I've done interviews on that for that record. It was there was nothing that was not deliberate.
Oh, it wasn't. Okay.
Oh no, it was deliberate. It was deliberate.
Like this kind of elevation of the non-human you know, the human world is very representative of a line of thinking that I really kind of appreciate. You know, this book is about, you know, essays or advice on living in a more than human world. I didn't want to say like, you know, the natural world, or I think sort of this idea that we are embedded in this world as well. So
that's right. That's right.
Represent sort of all these creatures and their way of life and sort of meld it into our own experiences, our own day-to-day lives, but on a level where it's like it's not a part, but it's like, you know, you can relate to it. I think that was sort of one of the intents I had going into the book. I'm writing about sort of this world that we may not know very much about, the experiences of all these creatures, but we are living alongside or parallel to them. you know, it's not a more than or less than element in terms of that. It's more like we are part of it as well. So I hope that.
Yeah, it does. And even the title, Utter, Earth, that has multiple meanings.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think that the title actually came quite quickly. I was just immersed in research and came across Nabokov's autobiography, and it's called Speak Memory with a comma in the middle. And I just found that title so evocative.
Yep.
In all these different ways, and there's a linguistic element to it where it the comma does something as well, and I was like, I want to steal that and incorporate it into my book. And utter, obviously, you know, utter earth has a lot of connotations, as you mentioned, utterly earth, you know, everything is earth, or utter as in the either, you know, this act of speaking,
right?
That's not language based. It's uttering. It's like a, you know, it's guttural. Also is related. So I wanted that element to be in it. And then is it uttered by the earth, or is it, you know, is it earth speaking through the many creatures that are part of it? So I wanted to sort of hit on all those notes, and I think that came quite quickly. I was like, yep, that's going to be the title. And then sort of the subtitle obviously came a little bit later, but I knew that that was kind of the germ of the story. And actually one of the essays in the book is also called Utter Earth, and it's right. Sort of broken up and sprinkled throughout the whole collection.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Isaac Yuen, a Hong Kong/Canadian author. And tonight we're talking about his first solo book, and it's really a wonderful read. It's an experience to read. Utter Earth, Advice on Living in a More Than Human World. Isaac, there's also a lot about naming in the book, and I found that fascinating. And there's a chapter, and I love the title of this, Yes, You Can Leave the Hospital Without Naming Your Baby. That was a weird thing to bring up. It was interesting.
Yes.
Is that true that you can't leave the hospital in some places without naming your baby?
Yeah, so that was a little factoid I received while writing the book. I was like, that's very interesting, this idea that you can have something that, you know, you can leave without having your baby named, and you can take your time to name your baby. And, you know, this idea or notion that you need to know sometimes – you need to know the individual or the baby before you can fit the name to it, you know, through personality-wise. So that title really stuck with me, and I thought that was a really funny and interesting entry into this act of what we do as humans. We need to name things.
Yeah.
And either to identify with it or to categorize it or to judge it in some way, you know, like I think that the essay later goes on to mention all the creatures that we name, some of them quite lazily because it's like, okay, that thing just like is a blank, blank, blank. And, you know, the qualities are just the ones we see and that's it, because there's maybe so many things to name and just don't have, you know, the time and the consideration to consider everything before we actually assign it a name. And then there are things where we put monikers or descriptors on it. It's like the lesser.
Yeah. You really, you go off on a tear on lesser.
Yeah. I was like, well, I don't know. I was trying to take sort of the perspective of the creature being named. It's like, hey, I'm not lesser or least than anything, you know, like
the lesser Isaac,
just as interesting as anything. So. Yeah, I think it's or something gets named magnificent. It's like, well, not everything is magnificent about it, maybe. So I just thought it was a fun way to explore the idea of us, the importance of naming,
yep,
and the importance of careful naming to sort of understand and not judge the creatures that we inhabit the world with. I do it myself, you know. It's like, oh, it's a lesser something. It's like, I prefer the greater or whatever. And it's like, well,
the greater's always better.
I know. It's like, well, I don't want to do that. You know, I'm sure the other one's just as fascinating.
Can I ask you to read a section of this book? For the people who've tuned in and are listening to our discussion, they probably have no idea about how your book is. And I think it's only fair.
Sure.
Yeah. So why don't you read something of your choosing?
Yeah. So I will read an essay that's the second essay in the collection. It deals with being second, and the title of it is called Second Best is Best. And so I'll just read the opening sort of section on it. And it's actually not about animals, but it's about a mountain. Second best is best. Sometimes being at the top isn't all that it's cracked up to be. Like if you were declared the world's tallest mountain one day by a Bengali mathematician and then named for a British surveyor you will never meet. The natural outcome of this is that tourists will start clambering all over you, ascending your north and south sides, leaving tents and oxygen tanks and corpse after popsicle corpse on your slopes. No, sometimes it is better to trail 1,000 feet below and cultivate your image cautiously, like how K2 worked its slow magic on Fosco Mariani over the years. Just the bare bones of a name, the Italian mountaineer waxes about Earth's second highest peak. All rock and ice and storm and abyss. It makes no attempt to sound human. It is atoms and stars. It has the nakedness of the world before the first man, or the cindered planet after the last. There's nothing quite like the feeling when someone takes the time to understand the persona you have tried so hard to project, in this case, rarefied and insuperable. To be sure, there's not much rhyme or reason to how fame is attributed. What did the dinosaurs do to deserve their fanfare when the pseudo-Suchians were the first archosaurs to exercise terrestrial domination? Yet, no plushie line for the plate-cover adasaurs. No book deals or feature films for Saurosuchus, T-Rex of the Triassic. And rare is the 5-year-old who takes the time to pronounce Dromicosuchus over its 5-syllable dinosaur equivalent. But maybe, in this case, the whole division is intentionally avoiding limelight, preferring to lurk from the shadows to sport the last laugh, or at least one of those toothy grins that is the winning feature of many an alligator or crocodile, under the radar survivors that outlasted the rock star relations. Technically, birds are also dinosaurs, but I had not the heart to tell my local caiman. Best to have them have this one small victory. So that's the opening for this particular essay, which goes on to talk about rhinos and hot chili peppers and other secondary things.
I have to say, I was like, when you were reading that, it really sounded like poetry. And I've had a number of poets read their works on the air, and it just there's something very poetic about your writing. And so it's in this.
Yeah, I think when I started writing, I think that one of the pitches for the book I had to sort of send as a book proposal is like I wanted to incorporate wordplay into earth play, and sort of the lyric element of it is quite important. And I generally write in verse first before I kind of translate into prose. So
that's
there's that element of rhythm and cadence that's really important when I write. And I hope that comes across in sort of the writing and the actual reading of it as well in someone's head.
Are you doing an audiobook of this, or did you?
No, not for this one, but I've had a couple of sort of read stories or things out there. I've thought about it, but it's currently something that, we'll see.
There are so many odd topics that you go into. For instance, sloths as perfect party guests. Are they?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the conclusion of the essay. The essay is called The Perfect Party Guest, and it was, when I wrote it, it was during the pandemic, and so I was just imagining what it would be like to invite guests when that was that would be possible again. So obviously in the animal world, I was going through all these very showy and flamboyant kind of creatures that would sound like they would be excellent to be at a party, but a lot of them are either flakes or very sort of, you know, look at me kind of thing. And I was thinking, you know, what would be like a kind of a surprise guest? And I think then it came to this sort of exploration of sloths and
capybaras. You know, like, you write about capybaras would be great too.
Yeah, they're very chill, very social. Like they seem to give out a pretty mellow vibe that would work in any social settings, and they're, you know, great in their own social circles. So I thought that would be a very good guess as well. But I think sloths are kind of the unexpected one that I wanted to throw in there. And then their history is very interesting evolutionarily. Like you look at sloths and you think they're slow moving sort of little creatures up in trees, but like their evolution history is kind of wild. You know, there's,
well, these giant sloths. Yeah,
geez. Giant ground sloths.
Oh my god. And they were giant. They were huge.
They were huge. Yeah, and I always have a soft spot for them, you know, reading and learning about their prehistoric world about them, so I wanted them to be featured a little bit more.
We are completely out of time, and we could literally talk about this book for hours and hours. And not only that, if you read the book, you learn about the Kate Winslet beetle. My guest returning today is Isaac Nguyen, a Hong Kong-Canadian author, and tonight we're talking about his first solo book, and it's wonderful, Utter Earth, Advice on Living in a More-than-Human World. Isaac, it's been a really pleasure, a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for having me again, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.